Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. You can watch today's program by going to Ustream channel and searching for Gary Null. Today, we're going to talk about sound therapy, a powerful tool for breast cancer healing, and also how a special extract of the Brahmi, or what is better known as a water hyssop, restored a lot of memory in this laboratory experiment, and how there are new merits to the Mediterranean diet, and starving cancer cells of sugar could be the key to future treatment, and how much could your blood pressure be lowered with a healthier lifestyle. A lot more on health and healing. Then we're going to look at how the brutalized become brutal. Truth Dig, Chris Hedges. Also, the recession continues for record numbers of homeless students. And yesterday I was on New York University's campus, one of the most expensive universities in the United States. You could pay between tuition, room and board, books, and being there for a year, $60,000. So it's way above state colleges and even other Ivy League schools that it would be compared to. So, though technically it's not really an Ivy League school, not like Brown and Harvard and Yale and Columbia. Why? Why is it so expensive? And what does it mean when a student is homeless but still going to school? This is a whole new phenomenon. So we're going to look at this. Also, we're going to look through Robert Reich's eyes at saving capitalism for the many, not the few. Why the economic debate in America must take into account political power. And then we're going to take a look at your water. It seems as if something that we brought to your attention over 5 years ago is now being recognized. All of the pharmaceutical drugs in small amounts, but still biologically active, parts per million and parts per billion. We're talking about turning on your tap, seeing nice, what seems to be healthy, clear water coming out, but also with that, antidepressants, chemotherapy agents, AIDS drugs. Yeah, it's in the water. We'll give you the latest on that. Also, why people's opinions should not matter, and yet we make what other people think of as so important. Boy, can that have a backlash on us. And then, why I refuse to let technology control me. I think you'll find this of interest. Also, we are approaching 19 million minutes of people listening on this program by telephone anywhere in North America. We're number one in North America, including Canada, people listening each day at noon Eastern Standard Time over the telephone. So if you're ever out, away from your land-based radio, or you're traveling, and you want to listen, write down this number, please. 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. Let's begin. We're always interested in what we can do to help prevent breast cancer, and if you have breast cancer, the best approaches. 99% of all people with breast cancer are going to be consulting an orthodox oncologist or cancer doctor. More often than not, it'll be recommended to have surgery, radiation and chemotherapy, and some combination. The trouble is we assume this all works, or they wouldn't be doing it. In point of fact, most of it does not, and there's very little science supporting it, but there's lots of money, hundreds of billions of dollars a year. So we're looking for the more natural approach. First and foremost, get rid of pro-inflammatory agents in your diet. Alcohol in amounts that are considered socially acceptable, they're not going to make you drunk, is enough to cause breast cancer. Eating a high inflammatory diet, things that are fried, overcooked, preserved, that causes inflammation. That can lead to breast cancer. And being nutrient deficient, vitamin D, vitamin C, the B complex, things most Americans are actually deficient in, that can also contribute. And stress, right at the top of the list. But now there's something new, and in today's world, stress comes in many shapes and sizes. According to Natural Health, quote, responsibilities, relationship issues, financial strain, and health challenges all add up to a toxic mix that can lead to a stressed-out mind and body. The relationship between stress and ill health is a vicious, albeit common, cycle. Quote, if the body is in perfect balance, there isn't much of a problem. That's according to Professor of Molecular and Cellular Biochemistry at High State University. When the body gets stressed, that changes the immune system, and the immune system is a double-edged sword. So it talks about how with this particular study, they found that sound therapy is based upon the concept that all matter is composed of and therefore responds to certain frequencies of energy. Quote, in Chinese medicine, they call it qi. In India, they call it prana, the life energy that comes in through the breath, chanting, and sound work, taps into the and intensifies that energy. That's according to a profound mind in the field who just passed, Dr. Mitchell Gaynor. And he did a lot of pioneering work in blending traditional oncology with alternative modalities. And also there's a work of the late Dr. Masaru Emoto, prove that sound vibrations can have an effect on water, which is significant since the human body is made up of 72% water. Now, new findings in physics based on string theory also prove that cells respond directly to vibration. Now, here's where it gets interesting. And here's where many of you in this audience who've come to health retreats or lectures understand that more than specific facts, or more than answering specific questions, it is the quality of the vibration that is shared, the energy that is exchanged. And we go through life, and frequently we'll have some exchange of energy, some remarkable moments. You're at a concert, you're moved by something you've read, you watch a video on the internet, and you're moved by it. There was just a short piece of... It was only about 20 seconds of Johnny Depp dressing up in his outfit from his Pirates of the Caribbean franchise and going to a hospital where there were children who had cancer, and the kids didn't know he was coming, and it was in Australia, and there he was in the hall, and he gave him hugs, and your heart just melts. The kids are excited. They're surprised. That's an energy exchange, and all positive energy exchanges can manifest positive health. It's hard sometimes for those who consider themselves intellectual, who are reductionist, who want everything proven by a mathematical certainty and model, to understand we're also a reality prior to proving it scientifically. Life exists before scientific verification. And even when they do verify it, they frequently don't understand it. And hence, they've reduced away the spirit, they've reduced away the vibrational energy, they reduce what life really is. It's just an energy. Take away the energy and you have a body with everything there. The eyes, the brain, the heart, the cells, everything that was there when you were alive. The only thing that's missing when you die is your energy. So where'd it go? And what's in that energy? Everything that we need. So any form of energy that can stimulate the body's immune system, soothing, breathing, relaxation, petting a pet, being with a loved one, holding hands, cuddling, all of these things stimulate a positive response to our immune system. And this is what they found in this latest one with sound. They found that it affects the natural killer cells. Now remember, both immune system impairing stress hormones that have a negative effect on natural killer cells, it suppresses them. and your natural killer cells normally combat the growth of cancer cells. In fact, a study done through the Meadville Medical Center's Mind-Body Wellness Center showed that those who were exposed to drumming, just an ancient practice of group drumming, increased killer cell activity and increased DHEA to cortisol levels. That means better able to deal with cancer. So sound heals. So be around sound. And if you can't be around sound, then buy yourself a video of waterfalls or rainfall, something, waves against coming in on the shore. It's all soothing and healing. Now, the Mediterranean diet is, for most people, the best diet possible. It's not a perfect diet. There are people in Crete who have a better diet, live longer lives. There's people in the Japanese island that live probably the longest lifespans on the planet for a group of people. They're Japanese, but they're also not as modern as life in most of Japan, and hence still sticking to the old traditions of taking their time, working. They don't rush. They're not as stressed. They're outside a lot. They have long friendships. They eat healthy foods. You don't find drug addiction or alcohol or smoking. And so that's important. But for most people, the Mediterranean diet is a good place to start. According to University of Vermont College of Medicine, it, quote, enhanced inflammatory response could be the key link between high saturated fat intake. There's your meat, all right? Every time you have pork chops, you know, steak, chicken, you're getting your saturated fats. Quote, and a recognized risk of obesity disorders, including type 2 diabetes and atherosclerosis. There's your heart disease. A new study in the Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry demonstrates that ingesting fats similar to those in the Mediterranean diet, meaning low saturated fat, mono, there's your olive oil, monounsaturated, appears to decrease the inflammatory response, both in comparison to a high saturated fat diet, as well as in relationship to low-fat diet. Quote, it has been recognized that obesity, a disorder characterized by abnormally high accumulations of fats in the body and an unhealthy diet, can increase the risk of chronic metabolic diseases such as atherosclerosis, type 2 diabetes, Alzheimer's, and that's from an MD, PhD, University of Vermont. So the takeaway message is this. In the Mediterranean diet, you're eating a lot of beans. You're eating a lot of green vegetables, including some. Probably the high end of that list would be, they actually use seaweeds. They collect some seaweeds there. Not everyone eats it, but that's really good. Purslane, which is very common. In fact, in the United States, almost no one in the general population eats purslane. I love it. It's crunchy. It's a little bit bittersweet. It's not too dissimilar from watercress, but it lasts a lot longer, and you can eat the stems, so the baby can't eat the stems. They're too pithy of the full grown, but it's loaded with nutrition. They have the Mediterranean diet. It gives you an enormous amount of variety of beans, olives, artichoke heart. They also give you whole grain pastas and whole grains. They get the real still-cut oatmeal. It's there, the one that doesn't cook in a minute but takes a while, but it's much better for you. It's very common to find people consuming honey instead of sugar, and they frequently will start with different types of olives and lightly grilled eggplant, onion, peppers, mushrooms, portobello mushrooms, and then in the center of a dish, they put the different types of olive oil and little pâtés of olives. So let's say you have a piece of eggplant, a strip of eggplant. You would take some of the, cut it in pieces, bite-sized pieces. Then you take a little bit of the pâté of olive and put it on there. And then you would have a brush, and you could brush the whole thing with olive oil. It's delicious, but it's nutritious. The more olives you eat, the better it is for your heart and blood sugar. The more olive oil you consume, the healthier you're going to be. So, and they generally eat one dish at a time. So they take their time, which means you actually eat less food. When you eat everything really quickly, your mind, your brain is telling you, I need all this now. And so you overeat, then you feel heavy afterwards. The idea of how much to eat is you should never feel completely full. You should always get up from a table with the desire to have more food. Then you're going to lose weight, you're going to be healthier, you're going to have less calories going in the body, longer life. A good article that I read from Nature Communications shows that all the cells in our body are programmed to die. As they get older, our cells accumulate toxic molecules that make them sick. In response, they eventually break down and die, clearing the way for new, healthy cells to grow. It is called programmed cell death, or senescence. It's a natural and essential part of our well-being. Every day, billions of cells die, just like I just mentioned, in order for the whole organism to continue functioning as it's supposed to. But as with any program, errors can occur, and injured cells that are supposed to die continue and grow and divide. And these damaged cells can eventually become malignant and generate tumors. In order to avoid their programmed cell death in this way, cancer cells recognize their metabolism as different and then reorganize it so they cheat death and proliferate indefinitely. That's why they're called immortal cells. So what they found was that keep away the sugar. Why? Because cancer cells thrive on sugar. And cancer cells always find alternatives between eating sugar and getting the glucose they need, no matter how little sugar we ingest. So when you go on a sugar-free diet, and that's what I recommend everyone I counsel who may have cancer, no processed sugars. And if the amount of sugar we eat doesn't affect this process, the question we need to answer is how the cancer cells are instructed to consume more glucose. So you need to keep off the sugar if you want to lessen the growth of cancer. By the way, I would also say do the same identical thing for sodium. The less salt you take in, the more potassium in its natural form you take in, the healthier you are when it comes to cancer, which was the basis of the Gerson diet. Dr. Max Gerson, a German physician who back in the 1930s found ways of helping people with tuberculosis by getting rid of the high salt preserved diets and putting them on fresh organic juices and fermented foods. And that's still going on to this day. But if you look, what's in all those juices? Potassium, antioxidants, phytonutrients. And when you get the sodium down and you get the potassium up through natural juices, you're helping the body. And finally, this I read from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, quote, dramatically lower systolic blood pressure, the big number after the blood pressure cuff has deflated, may be necessary to reduce risk of cardiovascular and kidney disease and even death. But current guidelines to keep systolic blood pressure below 140 millimeters of mercury might need to plummet below 120 to reduce the health risk of hypertension. So they're just saying get it down further, below 120. And that's good, because if you get it below 120, according to the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, they had this what's called a SPRINT study that shows that maintaining systolic blood pressure levels below 120 experienced a 30% fewer cardiovascular events, meaning 30% less heart attacks, strokes, and heart disease than those who were below 140. And there was 25% fewer deaths. That's big. That's huge. So if you want to prevent heart attacks and strokes, well, garlic, onions, vitamin C, coenzyme Q10, vitamin E, L-carnitine, hawthorn, ajuna, all good for you. But you got to also get rid of all that sodium and stress. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Many a tear has to fall, but it's all in the game. All in the wonderful game that we know as love. You have words with him, and your future's looking thin, but these things your arts can rise above.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. In our public health segment today, I want to follow up with what's happened in California. We know that we had a lot of demonstrations against mandatory vaccination, especially since the Senate Bill 277 and the SB 277 would not allow an exemption for religion or philosophical differences. And we have all the evidence showing the danger of these vaccines, and we presented them. And there were medical doctors like Dr. Tony Bark and others, toxicologists, immunologists, that went out to say, hey, before you require someone to take a vaccine, shouldn't you have the evidence that has been thoroughly tested in a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study where one group got the vaccine, another group did not get the vaccine, and then you follow them for 5 years and see, all right, what happened to the group that did not get any vaccines and what happened to the group that did? But they never did that. And we must suspect that there were some influence based upon the pharmaceutical industry, including the makers of vaccines, giving lots of money to the legislators who then voted for the mandatory vaccine. This is from Jeffrey Saxon from Health Impact News. Quote, California vaccine refusers get court order or CPS visit under this law. Quote, California Senate Bill 277 is setting a disastrous precedent by removing medical consent from California school children in 2016. In addition, the bill appears to be in violation of the Nuremberg Codes for informed medical consent. However, pressure is already being felt as school administrators and directors have chosen to ignore current law and force vaccine schedules on school children. Months ago, at the start of 2015 school year, California students faced a rude awakening as they were met with scare tactics and demands to vaccinate that had no legal standing. Latino mothers launched a formal complaint after their children belonging to the Los Angeles Unified School District were taken out of classes the first day of school despite having a personal belief exemption on file. Adding further to the confusion, the California Department of Public Health had not updated their website in Spanish to reflect the new SB 277 requirements and when they would take effect. So, as it stands today, in any school, preschool, or daycare facility does not accept a personal belief exemption for the 2015-16 school year, they are in violation of the law. Did the school nurses not get the letter from the CDAPH advising them the effective date? Well, so you got to get vaccinated out there, or you could find yourself in trouble or not being allowed in any of these schools. So it's bad and shouldn't be. We will have more articles on the dangers of the vaccines that are being mandated. So for the parents in California, a brand new documentary is being edited as we speak with all the evidence on the specific vaccines for California, which will also be the same vaccines in all the states. They use one state as a mandate and then they do it everywhere, a template. So we'll show you why, as an informed, educated parent, you should question the safety and efficacy of those vaccines. And I'm filming the leading toxicologist, immunologist, and healthcare advocates. Separately, for those of you who've taken Tylenol, new court documents, according to ProPublica and Jeff Girth and T. Christian Miller, the maker of Tylenol had a plan to block tougher regulation. Recently filed court documents show the makers of Tylenol plan to enlist the White House and lawmakers to block the Food and Drug Administration from imposing tough new safety restrictions on Tylenol. And an executive of McNeil Consumer Healthcare, which counts Tylenol as its flagship product, told the board of directors for parent company Johnson & Johnson about a campaign, quote, to influence the FDA and block recommendations made by an agency advisory panel in 2009. After Dr. Janet Woodcock, the FDA's top drug regulator, put off meeting with McNeil executives, the company's president, Peter Luther, sent out an August 2009 email, quote, we're being too nice and too worried about stepping on the FDA toes. It may be time to let members of Congress to put pressure on the FDA. Luther wrote to other top executives, quote, we have to make this our top priority and pull out all the stops. Well, here's my thoughts on this. Here you have a drug that in high doses is known to cause liver damage and death. And in fact, studies have shown the drug is one of the leading causes of liver failure in the U.S. And yet, unfortunately, when the FDA should be protecting us, then the legislators start contacting the FDA because of pressure from the manufacturer. Now, if you or I wanted to contact the FDA and say, hey, put some pressure on, your scientist to allow a toxic drug to go by, they're going to say, what are you talking about? We're not going to do that. You know, we work for the American public on all these issues. No, they don't. The drug industry knows that all it has to do is get its trade group, its lobbyists, to contact favored legislators who receive campaign cash in the pharmaceutical industry, and suddenly that legislator is all over a government regulatory body saying, back off, don't do anything. And that's why we have so many toxic drugs on the market. And finally, in this public health segment, the nuclear industry's ongoing cancer cover-up from beyondnuclear.org. Quote, vital cancer study canceled. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission will hide the truth about nuclear reactor risks. Quite simply, the nuclear power plant cancer link is clear, yet the new U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission continues to cancel important studies and hide vital information from the American public. Now, Beyond Nuclear, a leading U.S. Nonprofit on health and safety and environmental dangers of nuclear power, today decried the outrageous decision by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission to cancel a study that would have examined cancer incidents and mortalities and connection to the U.S. nuclear industry. Quote, study after study in Europe has shown a clear rise in childhood leukemia around operating nuclear power facilities, yet the NCR, or the NRC, has decided to hide this vital information from the American public. So says Cindy Folkers, radiation and health specialist at Beyond Nuclear. So that's that. Now, the whole study is only $8 million, and yet the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has a $1 billion operating budget, so it's a tiny fraction of that. I remember when I was doing my film, Knocking on the Devil's Door, and one of the people who volunteered to go door to door on the block where she lives and in the immediate area was a woman named Merrill of Merrill Lynch. And she said that she was not a smoker or drinker, had any risk factors, developed breast cancer, members of her family did, and the whole neighborhood had women who had no risk factors but had cancers. And she did this on her own time and found out that these were clusters around nuclear power plants. She lived near a nuclear power plant. Well, the two leading scientists, including Dr. Ernest Sternglass and Dr. Jay Gould, and I wrote articles on the dangers of nuclear power, and both of them had maps that show that with every one of the 100, and at that time, 104 operating nuclear power plants, all around it were cancer clusters, the hottest in the United States. And when those nuclear power plants closed, the cancer rate went way down. So shouldn't we know from the government's own research how dangerous it is to live within a certain vicinity from a nuclear power plant? You bet we should. And yet they cancel it. You can bet that they didn't cancel because it would have cost $8 million. They canceled because it would have stepped on some nuclear operating toes, and the nuclear industry didn't want to have any evidence that living near it could cause cancers. Now, we're going to hear from a retired narc the stunning inside view of how the drugs, the war on drugs, perpetuates itself. LEAP, L-E-A-P, co-founder and retired New Jersey State Trooper Jack Cole tells Tufts University student members about his very personal history in creating the self-perpetuating monster that is the war on drugs that I personally believe should be abolished, gone with, done, and let all those people who are in jail because of possession or use out. Let's listen to what he has to say.
I spent 26 years in the New Jersey State Police. 14 of those years I worked undercover in narcotics. I retired a detective lieutenant from that job. But when I retired, I felt very bad about my role in implementing what today I feel is not only a failed war on drugs, it's far worse. It's a self-perpetuating and constantly expanding policy disaster. And there's no way to fix it. There's no way to patch it up or repair it. We got to end it. We got to end it like we ended alcohol prohibition in 1933. When I went in the state police, it was 1964. That picture in the upper left-hand corner is a picture of when I graduated that year. And right underneath it is a picture more or less of when I graduated from their narcotic bureau. I went into narcotics in 1970. That was the beginning of the war on drugs. When I joined the state police in 1964, we had 1,700 troopers and we had a 7-man narcotic unit. Always seemed perfectly adequate for the job we needed to do. 6 years later, we had exactly the same numbers. And it was adequate because when we started the war on drugs, we really didn't have much of a drug problem in the United States. What little drug problem we did have was mainly soft drugs, drugs like marijuana, hashish, some LSD, psilocybin, the mushrooms, the mind-bending drugs. You know, the hard drugs, such as heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, were virtually unheard of back then. Certainly unheard of compared to what they are today. And if you go back and you look at the statistics from 1970, you'll see that the likelihood of anybody dying that year in the United States as a result of the drug culture was less than the likelihood of them dying from falling down the steps in their own house. It was less than the likelihood of them dying from choking to death on their own food at dinner. But we started a war on drugs. So you got to wonder, what was really the purpose behind this, right? In October of that year, thanks to this funding policy from the federal government, we went from a 7-man narcotic unit to a 76-person narcotic bureau overnight. All paid for by the feds. And this was replicated across the whole United States. Now think about that. When you increase the number of cops with one job to do by 11 times its size, you set up a great deal of expectation. Expectation with us in that coming year was that we were going to make at least 11 times more drug arrests than we did the year before, and we were literally off to the races. That's how this thing became a numbers game with the police. It's all about numbers. After 2 weeks training, They had the 76 of us line up, count off 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Every third person became an undercover agent. I was one of those three, so that's where I spent most of the next 14 years of my life. When we hit the streets, we were supposed to arrest drug dealers, and that was really hard because, as I just said, there weren't many drug dealers around. They weren't in, certainly in their suburbs, they weren't in rural America, they weren't in our schools. So instead of targeting us on drug dealers, they targeted us on young people, folks like you, people in college, people in high school or in between. And when I would weasel my way into these small friendship groups, groups of 10 or 15 young people, come Friday night, they're out of school for the weekend, or if they're working, they're off work for the weekend, somebody might say, hey, you want to get high? And if nobody said that, that was my job. So if anybody took me up on that offer, then one of the friends who had access to the family car or some other way to get to the city would go around to the others and say, hey, you want to get high tonight? Some might say, I'm studying for a test Monday. I'll catch you next time. Others might say, yeah, you know, while you're in the city, pick me up a couple joints, will you? Or they might say, you know, I hear there's some really good blotter acid out there. If you run across any, pick me up a hit of blotter acid. One dose of blotter acid. LSD. When they'd come to me, I'd put my order in for that same tiny amount of drugs. We're talking maybe $5 worth of drugs. They'd jump in the car, off they'd go to the city. An hour later, they'd come back and they'd hand those things out to their friends. When they handed it to me, they became a big-time drug dealer. Because that's what we labeled them. And that is what stuck. And I'd stay in that group until I got every single friend in the group. It was really easy to do because these people weren't drug dealers. They were young folks doing what we used to call dipping and dabbing, experimenting with drugs, and then accommodating their friends. They weren't making any money on this. They weren't even getting their gas money back for that trip to the city. So the second night, that person didn't want to make the run. Second night is person B, and third night is person C. And I would stay till I got every single person in the group. And I might be working 10 of these little friendship groups in different suburbs at the same time. So very quickly, I would come in with cases on a lot of people. About every 2 months, I'd come in with maybe 100 people that I'd had cases on like this. We'd have a big raid. 5 o'clock in the morning, we'd swoop into their neighborhoods with hundreds of cops and we'd kick their doors down and drag those people out in chains. When we got them all down to the police station, we would have already alerted the reporters to be there with their cameras and snap their pictures and the perp walk and splash them all over the front page of their local paper, destroying any credibility, any respectability that these young folks had. When we got them all lined up against that back wall, my boss would come out. And he'd say to those reporters, you see that? You see that? There's 100 major drug dealers we took out of your community. This is the worst thing that has ever happened in America. This is going to destroy society as we know it. And your only hope is that thin blue line of police. We need more money so we can hire more police. We need faster cars and better equipment and radios and guns that shoot a whole bunch of bullets and bulletproof vests. We need harsher laws. We need mandatory minimum sentences. We need 3 strikes, you're outlaws. We need. And the reporters would go away and write horror stories, scaring the public to death. And the public would read those stories and say, give it to them. And then we'd go out the next year and do even worse. And we've been doing that now for 44 years. Every year, worse than the year before. Now let me tell you about those young folks, what happened to them. Back in 1970, we only had one law about drugs. Wasn't like it is today. That law said it's illegal to distribute a controlled dangerous substance. And then it gave you a big long list of those substances. There was not even anything in that law that said any money had to exchange hands. Well, when Mr. Clinton was smoking but not inhaling was exactly when I was doing this to those young people. And he was college age at that time. Well, let me tell you, if I would have infiltrated his group, it would have been curtains for Mr. Clinton. You know, drug use is a very social thing, especially soft drug use. Six folks get up in a circle, spark up one joint, take two tokes, and hand it to the person on the right. And it comes around the second time, and people are getting high, and they're not really concentrating on what's going on too much. So the second time around, the person hands me what's now a roach. And I grab that thing and act like I'm what we used to call bogarting, like I'm going to smoke it all myself. But what I'm really doing is I'm knocking the flame off the end of that and sticking what's left of it in my pocket. Because that night, I'm going to submit that as evidence that the person who handed it to me is a major drug dealer. So if Mr. Clinton had been in that circle, it wouldn't have mattered whether he inhaled or not. The mere handing of that joint to me would have confirmed that he would never be an attorney, much less the President of the United States. So with that one law, since it was only one law, everybody was being sentenced exactly the same. 7 years in state prison. 7 years. They all had to serve a third of max before they could come out on parole. So 2.5 years after each one of these raids I had, another 100 young folks were coming out of prison. What were they going to do? We'd snatched them off the streets in the prime of their life when they're trying to get their education. They don't have any education. And if they did have education, who the hell's going to hire them? They're dope dealers. That's what we said they were. So what are they going to do to feed their families, huh? What they're going to do is they're going to turn right back to the drug culture, the very group we say we're trying to save them from. Only now they're going to become real, honest to goodness, drug dealers. And for every new real drug dealer, you got to have a whole bunch of new real drug users. So every one of those folks is out there actively recruiting younger people to pick up those needles and become the next statistic. And that, folks, is how this became a self-perpetuating, constantly expanding.
And you've just listened to the narcotic detective, Jack Cole, of the New Jersey State Police on that. It's just insane that we have a war on drugs. But then Prohibition was insane, and that gave us Lucky Luciano, Frank Costello, Meyer Lansky, Vito Genovese, Bugsy Siegel, and the beginning of organized crime. And how did that work out for us? So we should open these prisons, stop all this, and have places in every city in America where people go and be treated, and then have a real public education about why we are a nation that is looking for distraction from our pain, psychological, physical, and using drugs as a basis. Now, we have a lot of stuff, and we're always working towards more. George Carlin has a few thoughts about stuff.
I would have been out here a little bit sooner, but they gave me the wrong dressing room, and I couldn't find any place to put my stuff. And I don't know how you are, but I need a place to put my stuff. So that's what I've been doing back there, just trying to find a place for my stuff. You know how important that is. That's the whole meaning of life, isn't it? Trying to find a place for your stuff. That's all your house is. Your house is just a place for your stuff. If you didn't have so much goddamn stuff, you wouldn't need a house. You could just walk around all the time. That's all your house is? It's a pile of stuff with a cover on it. You see that when you take off in an airplane and you look down and you see everybody's got a little pile of stuff. Everybody's got their own pile of stuff. And when you leave your stuff, you gotta lock it up. Wouldn't want somebody to come by and take some of your stuff. They always take the good stuff. They don't bother with that crap you're saving. Ain't nobody interested in your fourth grade arithmetic papers. They're looking for the good stuff. That's all your house is. It's a place to keep your stuff while you go out and get more stuff. Now, sometimes you've got to move. You got to get a bigger house. Why? Too much stuff. You've got to move all your stuff. And maybe put some of your stuff in storage. Now imagine that. There's a whole industry based on keeping an eye on your stuff. Enough about your stuff. Let's talk about other people's stuff. Did you ever notice when you go to somebody else's house, you never quite feel 100% at home? You know why? No room for your stuff. Somebody else's stuff is all over the place. And what awful stuff it is. Where did they get this stuff? And if you have to stay overnight at someone's house, you know, unexpectedly, and they give you a little room to sleep in that they don't use that often. Someone died in it 11 years ago. And they haven't moved any of his stuff. Or wherever they give you to sleep, usually right near the bed, there's a dresser, and there's never any room on the dresser for your stuff. Someone else is on the dresser. Have you noticed that their stuff and your shit is stuff? Now, sometimes you go on vacation, you gotta bring some of your stuff with you. You can't bring all your stuff. Just the stuff you really like. The stuff that fits you well that month. Let's say you're gonna go to Honolulu. You're gonna go all the way to Honolulu. You gotta take two big bags of stuff. Plus your carry-on stuff, plus the stuff in your pockets. You get all the way to Honolulu and you get in your hotel room and you start to put away your stuff. That's the first thing you do in a hotel room. Put away your stuff. I'll put some stuff in here, put some stuff down there. Here's another place for some stuff here. I'll put some stuff over there. You put your stuff over there. I'm putting my stuff over here. Here's another place for some stuff. Hey, we got more places than we've got stuff. We're gonna have to buy more stuff. And you put all your stuff away, and you know that you're thousands of miles from home, and you don't quite feel at ease, but you know that you must be okay because you do have some of your stuff with you. And you relax in Honolulu on that basis. That's when your friend from Maui calls and says, "Hey, why don't you come over to Maui for the weekend? Spend a couple of nights over here." "Oh, no. Now what stuff do you bring?" Right, you've got to bring an even smaller version of your stuff. Just enough stuff for a weekend on Maui. And you get over, and you're really spread out now. You get all over the world! You've got stuff at home, stuff in storage, stuff in Honolulu, stuff in Maui, stuff in your pockets. Supply lines are getting longer and harder to maintain. But you get over to your friend's house in Maui and they give you a little place to sleep and there's a little window ledge or some kind of a small shelf and there's not much room on it, but it's okay because you don't have much stuff now. And you put what stuff you do have up there. You put your imported French toenail clippers, your odor readers with the 45-day guarantee, your cinnamon-flavored dental floss, and your Afrin 12-hour decongestant nasal spray. And even though you're a long way from home, you know that you must be okay because you do have your Afrin 12-hour decongestant nasal spray. And you relax in Maui on that basis. That's when your friend says, "Hey, I think tonight we'll go over the other side of the island, stay at my friend's house overnight." Oh, God. Now, what do you bring? Now you just bring the things you know you're gonna need. Money, keys, comb, wallet, lighter, hanky, pen, cigarettes, contraceptives, Vaseline, whips, chains, whistles, those in a book.
Now, I want you to hear something that I think is important. This is, we're going to hear Saving Capitalism from Professor Robert Reich, a person I have a lot of respect for. Think you'll find this of interest. Please listen.
One of the most dangerously deceptive ideas is that the free market is natural and neutral. The traditional economic debate imagines two parts to our economy, a private sector, that's the free market, and a public sector, that's government. In this cartoon version, the free market pays people and distributes goods and services in a natural or neutral way, and government intrudes on the market by regulating businesses and also taxing some of what businesses and individuals earn and then redistributing it. Much of what conservatives and liberals debate is how much government intrusion into the so-called free market is acceptable to achieve an economy that works for most of us. But this cartoon version leaves out a critical point. There's no free market in nature. The free market is a bunch of rules created and enforced by government. Elected officials, agency heads, and judges make the rules and sometimes change them. They create the market. And the real issue is who the rules benefit, who they hurt, and who has the most influence over making them. For example, the market provides bankruptcy protection for big corporations and billionaires, allowing them to shed their debts, including labor contracts. But no bankruptcy protection for college graduates overburdened with student debt. Trade agreements protect the intellectual property of large corporations, but they don't protect the accumulated skills of American workers. Big Wall Street banks and their executives are bailed out when they can't pay what they owe, but not homeowners who can't meet their mortgage payments. American industries are allowed to consolidate into huge near monopolies. Big cable, big pharma, major airlines, health insurers, Wall Street banks, big agriculture, giant retailers like Walmart. But workers who want to join together in trade unions face all sorts of obstacles. They're fired with impunity, and more states adopt so-called right-to-work laws that undermine unions. These are some of the rules of the so-called free market. If our democracy were working as it should, the rules of the market would help most of us. Instead, as income and wealth is concentrated at the top over the last 40 years, so has the power to make the rules of the market by influencing the politicians, regulatory heads, and even the courts and the lawyers who appear before them, with the result that the market is rigged for the benefit of the few. So if we really want to reduce the savage inequalities and insecurities most people are experiencing, we shouldn't be swayed by the myth of a neutral free market. We must make the market work for us, rather than for only a few at the top. And to do that, we must exert the power that is supposed to be.
And that's Robert Reich. Now I'd like for you to hear why I refuse to let technology control me.
Did you know the average person spends 4 years of his life looking down at a cell phone? Kind of ironic, ain't it? How these touch screens can make us lose touch. But it's no wonder in a world filled with IMAX, iPads, and iPhones, so many eyes, so many selfies, not enough us's and we's. See, technology has made us more selfish and separate than ever. Cause while it claims to connect us, connection has gotten no better. And let me express first, Mr. Zuckerberg, not to be rude, but you should reclassify Facebook to what it is, an anti-social network. Cause while we may have big friend lists, so many of us are friendless all alone. Cause friendships are more broken than the screens on our very phones. We sit at home on our computers measuring self-worth by numbers of followers and likes. Ignoring those who actually love us, it seems we'd rather write an angry post and talk to someone who might actually hug us. Am I bugging? You tell me, cause I asked a friend the other day, let's meet up face to face. They said, all right, what time you wanna Skype? I responded with OMG, SRS, and then a bunch of SMHs and realized, what about me? Do I not have the patience to have conversation without abbreviation? This is the generation of media overstimulation. Chats have been reduced to snaps. The news is 140 characters. Videos are 6 seconds at high speed. And you wonder why ADD is on the rise faster than 4G LTE. But Get a load of this. Studies show the attention span of the average adult today is 1 second lower than that of a goldfish. So if you're one of the few people or aquatic animals that have yet to click off or close this video, congratulations. Let me finish by saying you do have a choice, yes. But this one, my friends, we cannot autocorrect. We must do it ourselves. Take control or be controlled. Make a decision. Me? No longer do I want to spoil a precious moment by recording it with a phone. I'm just going to keep them. I don't want to take a picture of all my meals anymore. I'm just going to eat them. I don't want the new app, the new software, or the new update. And if I want to post an old photo, who says I have to wait until Thursday? I'm so tired of performing in the pageantry of vanity and conforming to this accepted form of digital insanity. Call me crazy, but I imagine a world where we smile when we have low batteries. Cause that'll mean we'll be one bar closer to humanity.
And we're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said, Georgia, Georgia, a song of you comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines. Other arms reach out to me, other eyes smile tenderly. Still in the peaceful dreams I see the road.